Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed the quick teaser, 6-minute teaser that I put out with this episode 3 days ago. I'm going to get into this episode 95 of the Neuro Experience podcast with Light Watkins. He's a master meditator. He's the author of Bliss More, How to Succeed in Meditation Without Really Trying. Guys, this episode is so exciting because I am a huge meditator and I talk about it a lot. I talk about the science of meditation, what it's done for me and what it does for brain health. And today in this episode, Light is going to bring light to the similarities and the correlation between meditation and brain health, meditation and success. And we're going to talk about the things that meditation can do for you on not just a mental level, but also a biological level. I'm excited to get into it. I hope you enjoyed the teaser. This is a full episode. Let's go. Light, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience. I'm so excited to have you here because I'm a fan of your book and I'm a fan of meditation, which you are, I believe, a master in. So before we get into anything, before I pick your brain, give us a quick rundown on who you are, how you got into meditation, and all about your book.
Quick rundown. I got into meditation about 22 years ago. I was living in New York. I was modeling at the time. I was dabbling in yoga. And back then the yogis were all talking about meditation as well. And I started going to this little meditation circle in Manhattan. And I remember being very curious and also very equally as frustrated. there weren't a lot of people that I knew who were meditating back in the 90s. And the people who were seemed to be kind of, you know, on the fringe of mainstream society because there weren't any apps, there weren't any mainstream books or anything like that. So it was kind of a novel thing. And I liked the novelty of it, but from a practical standpoint, it didn't really seem like I was making much progress. And I didn't realize until years later when I moved to Los Angeles and I started practicing, essentially it was transcendental meditation, how profound meditation could be. And I started to have really deep and tangible experiences. And that's when I became, I would say that's when I considered myself to be a meditator, you know, someone who actually, it's like when people are coffee drinkers, you know, they wake up and they need their coffee to get going. I needed my meditation to get going. And as opposed to someone who drinks coffee or someone who meditates, right? Like I drink coffee, but I wouldn't consider myself to be a coffee drinker, right? I don't wake up thinking, oh, I can't wait to get my coffee so I can get my day started. If there happens to be coffee around, I'll drink some if it's mixed with some really nice nut milk or something like that. But other than that, I don't really think about it very much. And I think most people have that sort of relationship with meditation where they kind of are appreciative of it. If it's around, they'll do it, but they're not necessarily waking up excited about meditating or trying to seek it out or rearranging their whole day around a meditation experience. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book, Bliss More, How to Succeed in Meditation Without Really Trying, is because I wanted to address that pain point that a lot of people have where meditation feels hard. It just feels challenging. They agree that it's good to do, that they should be doing it, and they should be doing it consistently. But we want to get meditation out of the, you know, take out the trash category, which is also something we should do on a regular basis. But how often do you wake up excited about taking the trash out? Like, you know, unless it gets really stinky in your place, you don't usually think about it very much. And we want to get it out of the chore category, basically, and into the I look forward to the things that we look forward to doing. Sunday brunch, you know, cuddling with puppies, you know, eating sweets, you know, these kinds of dessert like experiences where everyone kind of looks forward to it. And it's an indulgence almost. And I think meditation can be in that category for most people if they just knew what they were doing. And most people just don't know what they don't know how to convert the practice from being difficult to being easy. So the principles in the book that I wrote will help the layperson understand it well enough to be able to have some pretty interesting and profound experiences.
Well, you speak a lot about the many variations of meditation, and I know, you know, and we'll talk about this shortly around transcendental and Vedic meditation. However, you talk a lot about, you know, people believe that sometimes going for a walk in the park is their form of meditation, going for a bike ride is their form of meditation. Is there one correct way of meditating, or is it just however you can silence out the noise, sit there, be peaceful, be with yourself? Is that something that you describe as meditation?
You know, that's one of the topics that I've been addressing a lot lately in my newsletters and stuff, is this idea that anything that I do with mindfulness is meditation. And the confusion there is that those two terms, meditation and mindfulness, are kind of overlapping. They're both generic terms that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But in general, what I consider to be meditation is a seated, eyes closed practice. And it's not because, you know, I want to be pedantic or anything like that. It's just, according to the research, people who sit and close their eyes and have a structured approach to meditation are the ones who are able to yield the most classic benefits of the practice compared to people who walk around or who, you know, consider crocheting or riding their bicycle to be meditation. There's no studies that shows that has any sort of long-term stabilization effect on your nervous system. Whereas sitting with your eyes closed can actually de-excite your nervous system very tangibly compared to anything that you can do in the waking state. And therefore I think it deserves to be in its own category, the seated eyes closed experience.
I've been researching a lot about meditation and the link that it has between success. And I know you've spoken a lot about this in some of the interviews that you've done in the last 6 months, saying that a quiet mind is a peaceful mind. A peaceful mind is what may, you know, get you further towards success. Whereas a lot of people mainstream now in 2019, we believe that the hustle is real. You got to work, and that's, you know, and don't have any downtime, and that's what's going to get you success. So how could you describe the relationship between success and meditation?
Well, that's a really good question. And obviously the word success, which is very closely associated with capitalism and materialism, and you know, when we talk about what's successful in society, you hear roosters in the background. I'm in Bali right now.
He's in Bali, ladies and gentlemen. He's not on a farm somewhere.
Yeah. When we talk about what's successful in the marketplace, right? It's usually people who are able to make a lot of money, make more money than they're spending. And it's whatever variation of that is what's considered to be the most successful, right? If you look up a list in any Western media, the 12 most successful people to do, you know, in the world, whatever, they're all going to be business people. They're not going to put people up there who've volunteered the most or who've planted the most trees or any of that kind of philanthropic stuff that everyone kind of, you know, think, so I'll do that one day after I make my impact on the world, meaning after I make a lot of money and whatever, get a lot of influence. So naturally that carries over into the meditation world, and it can trigger a lot of people. You know, you shouldn't be using the word success in relation to meditation, because any meditation you do is good, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There is no bad way to meditate. There's no right way to meditate. As long as you meditate, that's all that counts. And, you know, that's all nice and fine. But again, I like to keep things very practical. And with any skill, right, take meditation out of the equation. Just replace it with anything, right? Calligraphy, karate, Jeet Kune Do, jiu-jitsu, right? You put any skill in the place of meditation, and we all agree that there are certainly best practices. And when you master the best practices, then you're able to engage with that activity in a way that feels more efficient and effortless, and maybe even in a way that feels enjoyable. And so that also applies to the practice of meditation. They're best practices, right? Our bodies and our minds are obviously, you know, unique. You know, we're all different shapes and sizes. And our nervous system, our parasympathetic nervous system, is all the same, no matter who you are, no matter what the package looks like on the outside. So when you understand how to meditate in concert with your body, your thinking mind, and your active body, then the practice becomes more enjoyable. And if you don't know that, then you end up inadvertently fighting against your own natural tendencies, which makes it less enjoyable. And so when I'm saying success in meditation, what I'm referring to is meditating in a way that feels enjoyable because you understand how the body and mind work in relationship to the practice. And just, again, to use a different metaphor that everybody's familiar with is swimming. If someone comes to someone who knows how to swim and says, oh, swimming is too hard, you know, swimming is not for everybody, or what's the best way to swim, right? Yeah, there's different strokes and different everything, but there's a common mechanics, right, where you can operate with the hydrodynamics of the water. And there are certain things you may do to fight that. Doesn't matter who you are or how many strokes you know, you're going to drown. If you fight the water, you're going to drown, right? And if you move in concert with the water, you can move in different strokes and everything, but still the dynamics are the same. You're moving with the water. You're not moving against the water. And you're breathing in a certain way. And so those apply to everybody. Doesn't matter what your background is. If you do that, the experience can become enjoyable. And I think everybody would agree that an enjoyable swimming experience is a successful one. One where you drown is an unsuccessful one, right? It doesn't feel good to drown. It doesn't feel good to think you're going to drown. So that also applies to meditation.
Yes. So I read actually a bit about Warren Buffett, and he believes in, and I'm not sure if it's meditation, but he believes in taking a walk in nature every single day, disconnecting from the world and just being alone with your thoughts and really, you know, deconstructing how you're feeling. And he really does that on a daily basis. So that's why I wanted to delve into that question. Now I want to move further along and talk about the link between brain health and meditation, because at NeuroAthletics, we do a lot of brain scans. And what we found is that we can look at a healthy, normal functioning brain, okay, and measure its gray matter and measure the actual size of the brain, and then put somebody on a 12-week meditation process. Whereas if they're sticking to, I guess, traditional Vedic meditation rules, which is 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at around 4 p.m., you know, don't quote me on that, but that's what I learned, then over a period of time, if they're consistent and they're doing it correctly, over a period of, let's say, 6 to 12 weeks, if you rescan their brain, you can actually see the growth in the gray matter. And that, to me, is absolutely beautiful, because there is science to suggest that meditation is very good, and meditation actually has an effect neurologically on the brain. Is there anything that you can add to that?
Well, before I get to that, I just want to rewind back to the previous comment you made about Warren Buffett, because I think this is an important point. It's not a mutually exclusive. You can take a walk in the park, disconnect. That's great. I'm not saying meditation should replace that. I think meditation can actually enhance it. If you sit down and close your eyes for 5 or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, then go for a walk in the park, I think you'll find your walk in the park a lot more enjoyable, right? So they support one another. Regarding brain health, yeah, I mean, it's the science is pretty compelling at this point. There's no doubt that there's definitely benefit when you sit down and practice on a daily basis. Who taught you Vedic meditation, by the way?
I'm from Australia originally, and my meditation teacher was in Australia. So I actually did a course, and it lasted, I think it was about a week, and we had to go in, or maybe it was 2 weeks, but I remember going in consecutively for about 4 hours at a time. And we learned like the education behind it. We practiced it together. And I tell you, it was very frustrating at the time. I wasn't able to really pick it up, but there was this light bulb moment. I think it happened like on the last time we were doing 20 minute sessions. And on my very last visit there, I finally felt euphoric. And I don't know if this is a normal thing, but when I was meditating, I was sitting there and something. I felt very euphoric and actually saw like the vision of my business. And I don't know if this is the what is meant to be happening in meditation, but this was around 2 years ago, and that's when I just became a fan. So I started doing meditation in the morning as soon as I wake up for 20 minutes and then again at 4 p.m. and I haven't looked back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, anytime you have a structured practice with anything, the brain is going to change. There was a wonderful study I read a few years ago about these. They wanted to test the brain connections related to playing the piano. And they had three groups of they had three controls. One group, they came in and they showed them this 5-finger piano exercise, and they had them rehearse it a few times for, I think, 2 hours a day for a week. And they found that by the end of the week, the brain connections responsible for the motor skills of playing the pianos on that particular hand had started to develop and hardwire from just the repetition. And then they brought another group in, and they showed them the same exercise, you know, and then they had them sit at the piano, except instead of playing, instead of physically playing that sequence, the chord sequence, they had them imagine that they were playing it. They had them visualize playing it. And they did that for 2 hours a day for the same length of time over a week. And by the end of the week, the same brain connections had formed in their brains as the people who had actually physically played the piano. And then they brought another group in, and they said, okay, you guys can play whatever you want. You know, these were not trained piano players, by the way. So they said, you can come in, just dabble, play whatever you want for 2 hours a day for a week. And by the end of the week, there were no brain connections that had been formed. And so the conclusion was, visualization is powerful, obviously. Structure is important. And that's what you're getting from your, you know, from your Vedic meditation training, is structure. That's what I get people in the book, is I say, look, you know, there's thousands of different meditations, but if you really want to affect your brain in the way that you've read about, you want to do the same thing every day. You don't want to, the people who say, just do what you feel, don't know what they're talking about. These are not people who have done the same thing every day for years and years and years. It's only people who have a hard time meditating who say, go and just do whatever you want, right? And that's the thing with most people out there, is they're well-intentioned, but most people don't really know what they're talking about. You know, because anybody can wake up and say, I'm a meditation teacher. There's no certification to become a meditation teacher. You can literally go to, like, you can download an app and do the app for a week and say, okay, I think I'm a meditation. I'm going to give up my accounting job because I want to be in the wellness scene. Now, what's the lowest barrier of entry? Meditation teaching. You know, even more than yoga teaching. Even with yoga teaching, you need a certification for the most part. You need to study for 200 hours. These guys aren't studying for 200 hours in their meditation practice. Most of these people who say they're meditation teachers don't even have a teacher. They're self-taught from apps and books and going to classes and things like that. And that's not how you become a meditation teacher. That's historically, that's never the way anyone who's become a master of meditation. No one taught themselves. No one even learned from a book. Anyone who wrote a book about meditation has a teacher. They didn't learn how to meditate from a book. So I think I'm not hating on anyone. I'm just saying, you know, the reason why people get so much conflicting advice out there is because most people don't really know what they're talking about. And unfortunately, unless you know what you're talking about, you're not going to know that most people don't know what they're talking about. Everything is going to sound kind of similar. Maybe until you meet someone like me and I can kind of go in and pinpoint and break things down for you. But that's why I wrote the book, is so that people can have access to this information so they can make more informed decisions. But yeah, and the brain is going to change and it's going to be wonderful. And, you know, so some of the side effects of that are, you're able to focus better at work. You're able to concentrate more. You're able to feel more intuitive. You're able to feel more, you're able to expand your perceptual acuity, which gives you the ability to see connections between things that may have mystified you before, but they've become obvious to you.
I'm so happy you said that. And I'm so happy you said with consistency and with doing the same thing over and over again, the power of repetition is what's going to pay dividends in your practice and in your life. And I wanted to ask you, what is your opinion on apps, you know, meditation apps?
Meditation apps are good for introducing people to meditation. I think ultimately, yeah, of course, you know, and most people who download the meditation apps are not people who are necessarily going to come and take $1,000 training with me, right? They're just not at that point yet. But maybe from the app, after building the habit of sitting for 10 minutes or 5 minutes a day or five times a week or whatever, they'll start to see enough benefit to understand the value of investing their time in a more consistent, structured practice. And that's usually who ends up coming to see someone like me. So I think apps definitely have a place. It's gotten more people talking about meditation than ever before, and it's just made it more accessible. So long as, again, people understand that there are levels, even to the meditation game, and the apps is like the first, you know, it's like the street level of the game. And if you want to have more profound experiences, eventually you're going to have to come off, you're going to have to graduate from using the apps.
I love that. So what are the, I guess, for anybody out there who's thinking, I want to start meditating, what would be the very first thing that you would tell them and how they can start their journey?
I'm a bit biased.
because the book.
That's why I wrote my book, is to help people who wake up and decide, I want to start meditating, but I don't really know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't know, you know, because just sitting down and closing your eyes is not really going to do anything, right? It's like if you want to start surfing, what do? Okay, I'm going to get a surfboard. I'm going to go to the beach. Okay. For anyone who's ever had that experience, you're going to learn really quickly. Surfing there's nothing arbitrary about it. The reason why they wear those shirts is because, you know, if you don't have one, your chest is going to get chafed from being on top of the board and hopping up and coming back down. Like, so you need the wax on the board to be able to stand on the board, you know, so you, all these little things, how do you carry the board into the water? Where do you sit on the board so that you have the best chances of popping up? You know, how do you engage with the wave, the oncoming wave? Where do you even go when you're in the board, in the water? Do you need to go? Where's the break? How do you read a break? How do you read when it's... So all these different things have an effect on the quality of the experience of surfing. And if you understand them, then surfing can be a lot of fun. Even learning surfing can be a lot of fun. If you don't know them, you're going to break your nose. You know, you may fall on some coral, gash your leg. I mean, you're going to come out of the water thinking, I don't understand why anybody would ever do this. This is horrible. This is the worst thing ever. And so whenever I hear people saying that about meditation, after trying it once or twice, oh, meditation's not for me. You know, this is horrible. My mind is so whatever. It just means you went surfing without any instruction. That's all that means. So the book, I think, is a good place to start because it takes you from A to Z, assuming you don't know anything about anything. And then it leads you through this sort of journey of understanding how your mind and your body works in relationship to meditation. And then I have a companion 21-day challenge that's free that helps people go through the book and get the most out of the lessons in the book. So it's not just you reading. It's actually a whole worldwide group of people who are going through this challenge at the same time. So you have accountability, and that's a huge factor in it as well. And then also, one thing I talk about in the book that you're not going to find in any other meditation book, and I get some, you know, sort of hateful comments about this from time to time, but this idea of making an exchange. You know, we have this notion that meditation should be this free thing, and it's free, and no one should earn a living teaching meditation, blah, blah, blah. And I tell people, if you don't have any skin in the game, you're not going to do it. I've seen it happen over and over and over. You know, there's plenty of free information and free meditation classes. How many people are taking them up on those offers? None. Because in our society, we don't value the things that we get for free. and it's like a free mattress. You know, if I had a free mattress that I wanted to give you, no one's going to take it. I've run that experiment before.
Yeah.
I remember posting this mattress on Craigslist, free mattress, come get it. It's clean. It's newish. I left it outside. No one came and picked it up. So then I raised the price to $100. Start getting a flurry of calls. Oh, can you hold it for me? When is it? Right now? Blah, blah, blah. The thing was gone in like 20 minutes after I raised the price, right? Because free is associated with something that's not value. It's not, there's no value in it. And the same thing applies to, you know, to these services like meditation. So anyway, all that to say, even though the 21-day challenge is free and the book is what, $15 or something like that, you want to actually initiate some sort of exchange. You don't send me money, but you should donate some money in the name of your practice, maybe volunteer time in the name of your practice, right? Do something that gets you invested in your practice, and that can make the biggest difference in this being something you keep for 5 days or 7 days versus something you end up doing for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
That's absolutely brilliant. One last question. How often do you meditate?
Same as you, 20 minutes twice a day, first thing in the morning and then again around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
This is something that I tell all of my athletes during their mental performance program to actually get on board and do. And when I catch up with them during their, you know, their face-to-face sessions, whatever it is, sometimes they tell me, you know what, I meditated, yep, I went good for 8 days and then I had a 2-day break and I'm trying to, you know, tell them that it doesn't work that way. Is there any light that you can shine on that?
Yeah, there's no accountability. There's no investment there. So, you know, there's nothing we can do to stop people from doing that, because until they see the value in it. And that's the thing with meditation. A lot of times, if you are self-taught, you're not going to feel the benefits for a while, because that you just don't, you're not going to stumble upon these mechanics. I didn't. I tried it for 5 years, knocking my head against the wall and frustrated, but I kept going back. And I was at every now and again meditator, you know, I'd do it just like that. I'd do 3 days on, 3 days off, 4 days on, 2 days off, like that. Cause that's what you think. Okay. Well, it's not really, you know, it's like sugar. You don't have to tell somebody to eat sugar every day. If anything, it requires Everest-like discipline to not eat sugar.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You have to give somebody $1,000 and bet them that you're not going to eat sugar in order to stop you from eating sugar, because we're also addicted to it. So when meditation gets into that category, you don't need any more discipline. And that's the beauty of it. But until it gets in that category, it's going to seem like it requires all the discipline in the world. And it's not because something is wrong with your mind or something that, you know, you're not equipped to meditate, or it's just, you just don't know what you're doing. That's all. So that's why I say starting with this book is this is the book I wish I had when I started. All these other books, the spiritual books, they're not written by meditation teachers. They're nice people. They're well-intentioned. They're researchers, doctors, and all this. But they're not on the front lines actually teaching people how to meditate over and over and over. And some of the feedback that I've gotten, you know, from the haters on my book is, oh, it's very repetitive and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you don't know what it's like to teach people. People need repetition.
Yes, I completely agree with you.
Right. They need things to be very, very simple, and they need repetition. And that's why I did the 21-day challenge, so that you can be guided through the process properly, so that you can get the most out of the process, so that you never have to come and pay me $1,000. If you are diligent enough and tenacious enough to go through this process, you can get a practice going. You will have questions later on. And I have an online community that I started called the Shala for people who read my book and they have questions, because you need to have someone who can troubleshoot your experiences. It's like getting an iPhone and there's no genius bar. So if anything happens to it, you just got to figure it out. That's ridiculous, right? You need someone who knows what they're talking about to give you suggestions based on that specific approach to meditation. And that's why I started that. And so people in that group get to ask me questions, and that way I get to keep them supported all over the world, and keep them consistent. Because the more support you have, the more consistent you're going to be in the practice. The less support you have, the less consistent. And that's really the bottom line. That's the correlation right there. So, and that's what I love about Vedic meditation is that you actually have support from a live teacher, the person that taught you. And that's why people who practice that particular style of meditation, they go from literally no meditation to becoming lifelong meditators. You know, people meditating for 10 and 12 and 15 and 20 years after having done zero meditation before that.
Well, look, I can vouch for that because I'm a huge fan of meditation. I'm a huge fan of your book. And thank you so much for actually shedding the light on how to start meditation, why to do it, and, you know, how everyone can start their journey. So for everybody out there, tell us where we can actually find out more about you, your social media links, where we can buy your book so we can all get on this journey.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, everything is on Light Watkins, lightwatkins.com. Light is spelled like sunlight, L-I-G-H-T. Watkins, WATKINS.com. And then on social media at Light Watkins.